Welcome to the College of Mythic Cartography podcast for May 22nd, 2008, hosted by me, Willem Larson. In this episode, I want to continue a theme I started of adulthood, commitments, understanding ourselves and each other, and how all that renews culture, renews a really original traditional culture, and how we can live wonderful lives doing that. I worry a little bit that what I'll say in today's podcast may sound a little esoteric or may seem kind of abstract. I actually worry that with most of the things I write, I feel strongly that they have a really concrete foundation, but I hear all the time from people who their first reaction to many of the things I write and talk about, their first reaction involves a kind of, oh, huh? How is this rewilding? So if you normally have that reaction, you'll probably really have that this time around. But honest, this is all about rewilding, I swear. The central message of this episode that I want to communicate is that as adults, as rewilding adults, our greatest power comes from who we sanction, who we invest in, and who we choose to collaborate with. Now, I believe that most civilized and domesticated people simply cannot wrap their heads around this concept. They've lived in a culture of punishment for so long that really they only know master-slave relationships. They only can think in terms of what people should do, you know, how they were wronged, who's at fault, etc., etc. And this whole other way of existing and moving through the world as an adult, of when you break trust with me, when you break an agreement with me, the only consequences are that you've broken my trust. And unless you repair that with me, and I may or may not have interest in pursuing it myself, you know, because maybe I'm recovering, maybe I'm already overwhelmed with other projects and issues. In any case, you know, I may move on and simply choose not to collaborate with you anymore. And that's the consequences of breaking trust with me. And those are enormously powerful consequences. I think in our culture, the rampant anonymity and expendability of everybody, workmates, boyfriends and girlfriends, neighbors, carpool buddies. I mean, we can move city to city, we can get new jobs, go to new schools, in theory anyway, and many people take advantage of this ability to this mobility. And yet, if somebody really chooses to move through the world, if a person really chooses to seek out people that can collaborate them in a really meaningful and nourishing way, boy, does that change their life. And it has certainly changed my life. I continue to improve my own skill at this, and I have a tremendous amount to learn. A tremendous amount to learn. And I don't know that it ever stops really challenging me. it continues to find my weakest spots and poke at them, you know, until I can grow to accommodate, you know, that new difficulty or that new stimulus. Because agreements, really, when we make agreements and when we choose to collaborate with people based on those agreements, really, what we claim is that we understand ourselves enough to know how we might act under pressure. And so we know what we can offer. And yet, we're constantly learning. You know, our bodies are constantly changing. We are in varying stages of health, varying stages of burnout, family pressures, friend pressures, social pressures of all kinds. You know, in this context, to make an agreement that you can stick to, if you don't have really deep knowledge of yourself, it's kind of like throwing a dart at a dartboard in the pitch darkness. And it's just totally assuming that if I throw it that way, well, I'll probably hit somewhere near the mark. And it really requires a lot more self-knowledge than that. Fortunately, as we, you know, continue to make agreements with each other, we can just continue to learn and get more and more knowledge about that. That's a natural thing. You know, you learn to swim by getting in the water. You learn to drive by getting behind the wheel. There's really no other way around it. So, what does it mean to make an agreement with somebody as an adult who rewilds? Some people know and have heard the stories that the original written democratic documents were written by pirates. Many in the Indian Ocean, some in the Caribbean. And these documents were known as the ship's articles. And in former times, really the ship's articles only concerned the wages, who was getting paid what. As time went on, they became to look more and more, they looked like mini constitutions addressing issues of, you know, what consequences if somebody wanted to desert ship in the middle of the voyage, or if they took more than their share, how you compensate someone for losing a limb. Oftentimes, those people who lost limbs would be handsomely compensated under these documents. Contrasting the powers of the captain and the as time went on, the more and more empowered position of quartermaster, who was there to counterbalance the captain. These pirates, rather than the movie pirates that we think of as either benevolent or malicious dictators, these pirates were really highly democratic teams of people navigating through a very chaotic but lucrative world. The amount of money they made truly boggles the mind. And they could afford to experiment. If you look at the pattern of these documents starting in the 1690s and moving on through 1720s and onwards, they become more and more and more free-thinking, experimental. Some of these documents experimented with not even having a captain, a specific captain role. It amounted to one document, one ship's articles per voyage, right? And a voyage, what, might last 6 months. So every 6 months, a person had the chance to totally tear down their constitution. Imagine if America went through this. Every 6 months, you just tore it to shreds, and then you rewrote it based upon what worked last time and any other stuff you might like to try. I mean, it was a really creative and innovative atmosphere. And every time one of those pirate ships went to sea, it was like a mini government. It just went out on the water, a mini cultural world. Now, of course, these pirates were highly influenced by indigenous peoples. Specifically, the pirates of the Indian Oceans, in the Indian Ocean, were influenced by the Malagasy, of St. Mary's Island, just near Madagascar. So these European pirates really ran into these pretty free-thinking, comparatively speaking, and free-living indigenous peoples who definitely had their own taboos, their own rules, their own ways that they collaborated and agreed on things. But it was nowhere near the institutionalized abuse and essential enslavement of sailors, both merchant and in the Navy. I mean, both kinds. So these pirates are an example of what could happen when you rewild. Many of these pirates took on native wives and never, ever returned to the Western world. And it's true that not a single pirate was ever captured at sea. Not a single one. The ones that were captured and hung were pretty much the only ones that had been tricked by seducing them with promise of pardon. And that got some. But for those that chose to stay in that world, it was a pretty sweet time. So we have a history of tradition that we can look back on that really works really well, of this ability to make agreements about endeavors and move forward. A great book to read about that is Honor Among Thieves. And I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing the author's name right, but it looks like Jan Rogozinski, JanRogozinski. I'll put it on the show notes. But that's a wonderful book if you want an introduction to this world of pirate accords, democratic pirate accords, and the first democratic documents, you know, before the American Constitution. And no, the Magna Carta was not a democratic document. It was an agreement between nobles and a king. And that doesn't constitute a democratic document because there were many people, many stakeholders not involved in that discussion, namely all the peasants and folks like that. So there's one piece that you can choose to be impressed by, and it certainly impressed me. There's a whole nother layer to it, though, that so what? Written documents, you know, what's the big deal? And, you know, I somewhat agree. Certainly native and indigenous peoples the world over have had democratic oral traditions and oral agreements they've made with each other for as long as we've all been human beings, you know, and spoken. In recent times, now that we've become literate, I see more and more use for writing things down. Certainly in the beginning of our cultural creation and our relearning of how to make agreements and resurrecting our ability to even have oral tradition and memory is a whole other endeavor. Having said that, there's another wonderful book about autonomous lawmaking traditions called Gypsy Law, Romani Legal Traditions and Culture, edited by Walter Weyrauch. So that book is all about how the gypsies, as an example of this autonomous lawmaking activity, how they do it, you know, how it varies across different cultures. There's no one gypsy law. There's a whole variety and diversity of different gypsy cultures that are ethnic gypsies, originating most likely from India, being as how their language is closely related to Sanskrit. But there's as many ways of doing gypsy laws, there are gypsy families, really. And that actually addresses a big piece of this, that many of these agreements and these this new idea, well, old idea, but bringing up in this new context, it's really about family law. Family law. And I think this is another really important point. This underscores even further why our greatest power comes from who we sanction, who we invest in, and who we choose to collaborate with. Because as I grow a larger and larger group of people who feel they can rely on me and collaborate with me effectively, essentially my family group grows. As we grow and grow, we become a kind of cadre, and then other cadres can choose to collaborate with us or not. And certainly we could turn them down. You end up becoming a kind of like a blocks of people with that kind of capacity. And we're back to that Mohawk sense of power of unity, right? The power of one-mindedness, the power to act in accord as one organism. And effective agreements make this all possible. That's why who we choose to collaborate, even if we're just starting with one other person, has so much potential. It's almost like it's an exponential activity or a geometric progression. I mean, once you start and you really have extremely high standards and are extremely picky about your collaborations and the clarity of your agreements, amazing things begin to happen. Really amazing things. Life gets better and better and better. So the funny thing that really actually started me on this new tack is that I recently ran across a book by Stuart Levine called The Book of Agreement. This has been my week of books. And what really impressed me about this book, Stuart Levine is an ex-lawyer, and essentially articulated something that I'd been working on myself and in partnership too with my friend Julie Kramer, and experimenting with through Trackers Northwest and in partnership with my friend Tony. Stuart Levine calls a culture of agreement, which is just a wonderful, wonderful phrase that he's coined. And really, I mean, it just really rings a chord with me. That clarity and agreement are really what it all comes down to. And in your agreements with other people, there are important aspects that you have to cover, really important aspects. In his book, he really lays them out. And so I'll just tell you what he says, that in an agreement, there are 10 elements that you can just go through in order. You have an intent and a specific vision. That's the first. The second is you have roles that you define. The third, once you've defined those roles, then what are the promises and commitments to action that the different roles will take? Once you have those commitments, well, fourth, you need a time, a deadline. And some sense of that this, so far, the value of doing all these things, that it is a fair value. Fifth, how will you measure whether it's been a satisfactory experience collaborating? right? What are the specific measurements you'll use? And it'll surprise you. Different people have radically different measurements when they don't articulate them out loud. And so it's important to get on the same page. Six, he suggests that you go over your concerns, your risks, and your fears. Just bring them out. Be clear about them. Seven, he talks about what guidelines will you have for renegotiation or dissolution of the contract. Eight are the consequences of not collaborating and for breaking the contract. Nine is how you plan to resolve conflict. And 10 is finally sign on the dotted line. Do we have an agreement? Do we have an agreement? And in order to go through this agreement process, it's important to stay focused on what you want to create together. What adventure do you want to go on? Now, classically, I hadn't really thought about this, but the author, Stuart Levine, makes a good point that in our culture, most agreements concern protecting ourselves from harm, you know, not letting the other guy screw us. And what I hadn't realized was that a parallel evolution is going on where me and other people are discovering that really life-affirming agreements wholly concern themselves with what we want to create together. And the consequences of breaking an agreement are simply renegotiating a new agreement. And that agreement may be not to collaborate. Also, that the new agreement may simply be one that is more has a more realistic assessment of what different people can do. And I think that's a worthwhile thing to note. That to break an agreement doesn't mean lies and wrong and censure and condemnation. It means we've learned something about our collaboration. Can we still collaborate? Can we move forward? How must we change the agreement to make it work? In theory, you know, what we wanted to do together was worth bothering over in the first place. So is it still worth it? And if it is, what do we do? In this process of dialogue, of creating this document, written document or oral document, but probably in the beginning it needs to be written, we come from a place in our dialogue of telling a story or asking a question for clarity. And there, once again, there is that sense of needs and feelings. As I tell my story about what I want out of this agreement and where I want to go and what my fears and concerns are, those are all needs and feelings and my strategies for meeting them, right? And this accord, this agreement, is one strategy to meet, or is a bundle, actually, of strategies to meet needs of mine and yours, too. So it all starts coming together in this way. So we tell our stories, we ask clarifying questions, and then we come to an accord. Now we get to the part where we really start pulling other things in, because agile teamwork, as I probably haven't talked a whole lot about at the College of Mythic Cartography, I've talked about in other places, but agile teamwork is basically based on a lot of these same concepts, a lot of very similar ideas of how people work and what it means to collaborate well together, and what, you know, non-hierarchical agreements and all of that. The difference with agile teamwork is it's based on a core, ever-evolving agreement that it's simply constantly adapting to new conditions. And so I want you to see a timeline or a continuum that goes from one end to, say, the American Constitution, which is absolutely chipped in stone and very difficult to change, right? And also not so relevant, right, to modern needs necessarily. Some may argue that, but certainly as a person who rewilds, I look around and I see a lot of unhappy people that don't seem to have the rich life that the constitutional document seems to promise. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? So what happens when a document is so difficult to change that you can't keep it current and make sure it's always addressing the needs, the current needs of people, keeping it relevant? Well, this happens. This culture happens. And then you have these pirate documents, which would change every 6 months or so, whenever, you know, their adventure was over. And then you have agile teams where they basically have a big board, say, with a big bulletin board with corkboard, or say a wall covered in stickies, or a whiteboard with scribbles, and iteratively every week the collaborators sit down and they look at their current state of things and they change their agreement around. So they're constantly renegotiating, resolving conflicts, you know, digging up unaddressed needs, all that stuff. And that's called, part of that is called a retrospective, where in an agile team, you look back on what has come before. And then the other part where you make a new agreement is the planning process, right? And there's a methodology for brainstorming and coming up with, you know, where we go next. So this is where, for me, I don't know if this will trigger the little fireworks and explosions in your brain like it did for me, but I've just really had a realization of late of this continuum of agreements and how adaptive they can be. And it's not necessarily appropriate that agreements be changing every second, you know, or every day or every week. You know, there may be times when 6 months or a year or 10 years is an appropriate amount of time to stay true to an agreement or not. I mean, this is really something we're all discovering together, right? And in the end, the only evidence that can either support or undermine a case for any one of those styles of agreements is what feelings we're having and what needs they point to, what lacks or surpluses that we're experiencing. Are we thirsty? Are we hungry? Are we getting shelter? Are our families clothed? Are people feeling heart's ease and enacting purpose? This is what it will tell us what the parameters of our processes and our agreements need to be. It's very simple. So I hope you've enjoyed this exploration of this web of ideas and this invisible social technologies that continue to be my favorite rewilding topic. And the biggest puzzle for me of how to reestablish these traditions. So thank you for listening. And I'll catch you next time here on the podcast for the College of Mythic Cartography. Recorded May 22nd, 2008. Thank you to Mike R. for making this podcast possible with your donation for the archiving of College of Mythic Cartography podcasts.